My name is Anshuman Chaudhary, and you are listening to another episode of the Barbed Wires podcast. The last time I recorded an episode was in March of this year, which you could say was a long time ago. That episode was on China's conflict mediation in Myanmar. A lot has happened in the country since then. When I say a lot, I mean a lot. Especially since October 27th, when three ethnic armed organizations began a series of coordinated offensives against junta targets along the Myanmar-China border. Those offensives are now being called Operation 1027 or 1027, and they have spread to several other parts of Myanmar. But before that, I made a promise to you in my first episode, which is that I'm not going to make this podcast a series of monologues by me, where you just have to listen to me ramble on and you get bored of my voice. So I'm keeping my promise in this episode, and I've invited a very special guest. Today I have with me James, who's a researcher at the Myanmar Policy Institute or MPI. And James is going to help us make better sense of Operation 1027, its geographical spread, the various actors involved, and what all of this means for Myanmar's future and also foreign relations. Full disclosure for our listeners, James has chosen to be anonymous for this episode because of security reasons, so we are using a pseudonym for them. I will actually let James describe what they do. James, thanks so much for taking out time and joining me on this podcast. Tell us about your work.
Hi, Anshuman. Thank you very much for having me on this podcast. I am a researcher with the Myanmar Policy Institute. My focus is on Myanmar's external relations. And before the coup, I was working as a Myanmar foreign policy analyst. And since the coup, I have been helping the pro-democracy resistance with foreign policy advisory.
Thank you, James. Now jumping straight into what's happening in the country. As I said, since October 27th, there have been coordinated offensives, now called Operation 1027, which has spread across Myanmar. But I will let you explain to our listeners, a lot of whom might not be aware of the context of Myanmar or what's going on in Myanmar, let alone Operation 1027. I'll let you explain what Operation 1027 is and how you generally see the whole coordinated offensives, the geographical spread of it, and the various actors involved. Please help us make better sense of it.
Thank you, Anshuman. So Operation 1027, so-called and so-named because it the Brotherhood Alliance, the MNDAA Koga, the Arakan Army, and the Dao National Liberation Army launched their coordinated offensives on October 27. Well, actually, it's been almost a month. It took a lot of people by surprise, but the interesting thing is when a few days after the offensives were launched, there were leaks in media of SAC internal memos where they knew that these pretty large-scale offensives were coming, but they weren't able to gather enough manpower to reinforce and fortify their positions in northern Shan State where the operations were launched. So within 24 hours, 48 hours of Operation 1027, several dozens of SAC camps, both small and large, were captured and attacked. And now the coordinated offensives have been joined by offensives launched in other states and regions in Myanmar as well. In Kareni State, which is actually adjacent to Naypyidaw and southern Shan, there's Operation 1111, which was launched on November 11. And then in Rakhine, the Arakan Army has launched a string of offensives as well. And then in other areas, in Chin State as well, the Chin resistance forces have captured border outposts and SAC camps as well. So what began as a coordinated offensive in Shan State, in northern Shan State, right along the Chinese border by the Brotherhood Alliance has now become a nationwide offensive against the SAC. And in fact, today, the Brotherhood Alliance announced that they're going to step it up from, Operation 1027 to a nationwide operation, and they have involved the whole of the public and other resistance troops to join them as well in launching attacks against the SAC. So when Operation 1027 began, within 24 hours, the first border town that the Brotherhood Alliance took was Qin Shi Huang, one of the official border trade outposts with the China along the China. So that put a halt to a lot of activities along the border, especially bilateral trade with China. And in addition to Qin Shi Huang, they took a couple of other border trade outposts as well. So essentially, what they did was secure, well, in a sense, first, like disrupt the SAC's border trade with China, and also secure and also recapture the Brotherhood's territories, especially those of the MNDA and the TNLA that they lost in fighting with the Myanmar Damodar a couple of years prior to the coup. So this is gaining traction. The SAC has suffered an embarrassing string of losses over 170 camps, big and small, taken. Over 260 troops have surrendered nationwide. And, several tanks, at least five tanks captured and destroyed, howitzers, even two multiple rocket systems captured by the Brotherhood Alliance, and a plane taken down by the Karenni Defense Forces in Karenni State. So overall, a lot of people are saying, and I, from my assessment, correctly so, that this is the beginning of the end for the SAC.
Right, you just said it's been a month. It just struck me, yes, it's been a month, which we probably a lot of us following the events in Myanmar never realize it's been going to be a month since Operation 1027 began on the 27th of October. And I think that itself shows the intensity of the events since then. So you said there's a general sense, and you also alluded to it, that it's almost the beginning of the end for the SSE. And just for our listeners, SAC means the State Administration Council, which is what the junta calls itself in Myanmar. So yeah, in just in case you didn't know that. So there is a general sense, and I want to come back to this point again, that there's a general sense that the SAC is going to collapse very soon. And because, mostly as we can see, deployment lines are stretched, supply lines are also constrained. The SAC is having to deploy large amounts of troops to certain concentrations of areas. Particularly now, we see more deployments in Rakhine State. We also see deployments around Naypyidaw, the SAC administrative capital. We also see deployments in the north. So we see that all along in every possible theater, the SAC is under tremendous stress in many ways. In that sense, how do you see the SAC's strategy going forward? Because we've seen that it's been unable to recapture a lot of the towns and urban centers and bases that the Three Brotherhood Alliance has captured in Northern Shan State.
Honestly, I'm not sure if they are not just like what you said. They're unable to capture the towns, the SEC camps and bases that they've lost to the Brotherhood Alliance and to other groups elsewhere in the country. Let's not even talk about recapturing what they've lost. Let's start thinking about their inability, which is becoming increasingly apparent, to even continue defending the bases, the territories that they still have, which is shrinking by the day, right? And the most interesting, I would say the most interesting and encouraging part of Operation 1027 and other operations elsewhere in the country, other offensives against the SAC elsewhere in the country, is at which SAC troops are surrendering. Right. When you look at Northern Shan, one very famous incident was in Laogai. An entire battalion, 150 26 men plus their family members, 134, who were living in the compound. They surrendered, right? And this was about over a week ago in mid-November. And now the MNDAA have announced that they will be attacking and capturing Laogai. And the Chinese government has also told their citizens, anyone who's left in Laogai, to evacuate, right? So, and another instance where I believe around 40 plus SAC troops surrendered Guarani State as well. So elsewhere, all over the country, but particularly in northern Shan State, at least over 260 SAC troops have surrendered. And there was an incident where an SAC base in along the Myanmar-India border was attacked, and SAC troops, they ran away, crossed the border into India, and the Indian military and government, they sent them back into the SAC's hands. And very recently, some of the troops who were sent back, they were sent to the front again. I believe in Chin State, have to check, but at least two of them who were sent to the front by the SAC, they surrendered. And according to the two who surrendered, they said, they're not interested in fighting anymore. They were just looking for an opportunity. They don't want to be handed back to the SAC. And even more interesting and perhaps somewhat hilarious is that their commanders wouldn't would were have been very careful to let them take any pieces of clothing that were white, because they could use it as a white flag of surrender. So the two guys who surrendered actually used a white plastic, attached it to the top of a stick and surrendered. So this is, to me, very encouraging. And the way these SAC troops and camps are surrendering, it appears as though they're really just waiting for the adversaries to come to their base so that they're able to surrender, which makes sense because, they're if there aren't any PDFs or like resistance or troops or EROs attacking their bases, then they can't simply, bend and post and run away. For a lot of them, their families are either in Naypyidaw or elsewhere in SAC Defense Services military family compounds, right? Those people be threatened if they surrendered and ran away. So that's the interesting and encouraging bit, the rate at which they're surrendering.
I'll come to the India part. You mentioned about the SAC troops crossing over into India from Chin State and being sent back. So I'll just come to that in a while. But before that, I'm really fascinated by this whole wave of defections, right? We've actually been seeing defections since over the last 1.5 years almost in Myanmar. But right now, the kind of defections that we are seeing, I think the scale of it is much bigger, especially after 1027. And I think what the Three Brothers Alliance in Northern Shan State did was quite interesting, which is sort of offer an open amnesty deal to the troopers, right, to the rank and file. That if you defect, we'll give you significantly large sum of money, but we'll give you safety, we'll provide security for you and your family members. I think that's a good way to sort of induce more and more defections from within the SAC, and bring them over to the resistance side. But do you generally see, I just while we're on this topic, I just want to pick your brains on what do you think would be the future of a post-SAC security order, in the sense that do you think these SAC soldiers can be reintegrated into a completely refurbished, restructured National People's Army of sorts that comes after the SAC? Do you think that's possible?
You just opened a whole can of worms. Honestly, not sure how exactly the security landscape post SAC will look like, particularly the new, what everyone's talking about, the federal army that's going to come post SAC. But what I do think is that I believe either it was either early this month or last month that the announced that There would be a transitional national unity government after the fall of the SEC that would be responsible for transition to federal democracy, while the Constituent Assembly, which we don't know what it's going to look like yet, is going to draft a constitution, and then there's going to be a referendum. So during the transitional period, though, my assessment is that the Transitional National Unity Government will be in charge of the security sector reform. But beyond that, it's to crystal ball gaze and say exactly what this new security force, what's this new military that's going to replace the Dumadaw is going to look like.
Before we come to India, I think there's a, I mean, and there's a good reason why we should talk about the India angle here, because suddenly there's a lot of interest on Myanmar in India. In fact, I've never seen such high levels of interest in what's happening in Myanmar since the coup in February 2021. So we'll definitely talk about that. But before that, let's talk about the other big neighbor, right, which has been in the news in light of Operation 1027, which is China, right? So, you know, there's almost like a sense that there's an elusive role that China is playing. But at the same time, we've seen a lot of commentary and analysis, which sort of, you know, almost centers China in this whole offensive at the cost of decentering the ethnic armed organizations who actually are leading the offensive and the national resistance in Myanmar, right? And there's this almost seduction of attributing everything to China. And we have seen that all around, right? That China is almost remote controlling what's happening. Without China's green light, this couldn't have happened. It's simply China who's maneuvering the entire conflict. I personally think that's a very, very limited view of what's happening. The ethnic organizations there, most prominently the Three Brotherhood Alliance and also the FPNCC, have their own ways of working. They have their own strategies, aspirations, and political agenda, and their own sort of battlefield sort of dynamics, right? So I think it's unfair to attribute everything to China. Also, I would say it's an insult to the people of Myanmar generally, who have been relentlessly fighting the SSC over the last more than 2 years now. So this is what I generally feel. But James, what do you think about this? What do you think generally of China's role specifically with regard to Operation 1027 and beyond that also, the overall landscape, the political and security landscape there that we are seeing in Myanmar today?
That's a great question, because that's a question on everyone's mind, as you said. And as you said, attributing the whole of Operation 1027 and the ensuing success to China sort of being the puppet master behind the scenes, which, by the way, is very similar to SEC speak. Right, their conspiracy that China's behind this, China's controlling all of it, the puppet master behind it. It's yeah, like you said, it's insulting to the Myanmar people, 50 million plus, who have been so bravely fighting against the military junta, resisting in every way that they can. And it's also an insult to the Brotherhood Alliance and other resistance forces fighting against the SEC. It's almost as though it's a they're the type of rhetoric is taking away completely the agency of the Brotherhood Alliance, of the Myanmar people, and of the ethnic resistance armies, right? Having without China's even if you don't want a blessing, you can at least say without agreeing to look the other way, Operation 1027 probably would not have happened, considering the where the Brotherhood Alliance, especially the Gokan and TNLA, are based, and also let's not forget the Kachin Independence Army. Their headquarters lies right along the border as well. And even if we're talking about American Army, where yes, they have. They've always had a presence in northern Shan and Kachin and elsewhere. But even if we're talking about just Rakhine, there's China's deep sea port, Jiaopu, and given the history of how the American Army was formed, with a great deal of help from, especially the MNDAA and KIA, yeah. Well, China definitely does have a hand in this. And I think on the part of China, when we in China's shoes, they initiated and signed several MOUs for the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor under the pre-coup National League for Democracy administration led by Aung San Suu Kyi, right? Things were going all right. The MOUs, at least 30 plus projects, MOUs were signed and feasibility studies were supposed to start. Some probably have started. And then along came COVID. And then, right smack in the middle of the COVID pandemic, 2021, along came Miao Lai and his brilliant idea to launch a military coup. Right. And had Miao Lai and the SAC been able to consolidate power and kept political stability, kept the economy going, China might have, things might have turned out differently. China probably would have been able to proceed business as usual, implement the rest of the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor projects, do the feasibility studies for the MOUs that were signed for the projects, etc. One, the SAC was not able to consolidate power, and by the second year, it was starting to lose territory as well. And it was losing on all fronts, politically, diplomatically, even economically as well. And in addition to that, because of the political instability, because of the security landscape and deterioration in security, especially along the China border, a lot of those, the scam centers that already existed pre-coup. Run, by the way, by most of them run by Dumbado affiliated militias, right? They got out of hand, and the SAC wasn't able to deal with those scam centers where hundreds and hundreds of Chinese citizens were being trafficked, even though the Chinese government has requested them multiple times. Actually, before Operation 1027 began, the Chinese ambassador in Yangon met the SAC, I believe, at least seven times and raised the issue, the problem of the scam centers and all the Chinese citizens who were being trafficked. The SAC, every time the SAC would go, oh, yes, well, but they haven't been able to. And I'm sure there are multiple reasons why, one of them being the fact that these are the money-making machines for the SAC affiliated militias, which were, the eyes and ears of the SAC in northern Shan State, and also the only ones who would, well, at least at the time, would be loyal to the SAC. It makes sense for China to finally say, we've had enough. You're not able to run the country like you promised you'd be able to. You're not able to comply with our requests. You're not able to really do anything for us. You're not of any use to us anymore. The Operation 1027, they already had leverage, their strong affiliations, the Brotherhood Alliance and other EOs in Shan State. They gave the green light. So it's not surprising that things turn out this way. So going back, yes, it's important to recognize the efforts of the Myanmar people and not forget about agency when it comes to EROs and ethnic resistance groups in general in terms of their efforts against the military junta, but also we should really look at China's role in this quite seriously as well.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for that. I think it's this is pretty much the point, that it's not this or that, and it's somewhere in the middle. These things are always complex. They're always gray, right? So I think I appreciate that very much, because I've seen some headlines which Personally, if you ask me, I find them cringe, which is, stuff like China has lost control of the ethnic armies along Myanmar's borders, as if they were just simply dancing to China's tune, right? Beijing's tune. So I think there's a lure, especially I've seen this tendency in both Western and non-Western journalists who don't belong to Myanmar, especially, that they have this lure of sort of linking it linearly, drawing a straight line from what's happening in Myanmar to China. So I think you pretty much put the record in its right place. So I do feel there's a general sense in Beijing, kind of frustration with the SSC, that nothing's moving. That the SSC is not listening to China. It's not sort of honoring China's political, security, and economic interests. And of course, the scam centers around Myanmar, which, by the way, don't just operate along Myanmar's frontiers or borders, but are also very much present in major urban centers like Yangon. So I think China was pretty frustrated with what was happening, and the SSC was not, as you said, the SSC was not honoring China's demands. So I think generally, even in terms of BRI, I don't think most of the projects are moving. So I do, as you said, also feel that there is a sense of kind of anxiety and frustration, and about the immovability of the Myanmar, the intractability of the Myanmar situation. So I think the Chinese would like to proceed with the BRI projects as early as possible, and Mae Nong Line is not letting that happen in many ways. On, I think, China, Myanmar, I would encourage our listeners to check out the work of Jason Tower from the United Institute of Peace. He follows this issue very closely. You can follow him on Twitter, and also you can check out his work on USIP. He does very deep dive work on particularly the border interests of China and how it relates to the ethnic armies in Myanmar.
I just want to add that, the Myanmar military, right? So it started like this. A couple of weeks after Operation 1027 started, the military spokesman, Saw Min Tun, came on the record and said, well, they captured some from the Brotherhood Alliance, and they found that the weapons were China-made, which is something that they said when they captured some weapons from the American during the 2019 operations in fighting in American state as well. So the moment I read that, I thought, all right, these guys need to say something about China. This is an indirect way of saying that they're not pleased with China, that they know China is sort of behind this in some fashion, right? So he said that. And fast forward a couple of days, I think not even a week, the military's proxy groups, the nationalist Buddhist monks and some of their political supporters, staged public protests in the center of Yangon and also outside of the Chinese embassy in Yangon, shouting all these slogans. Many of them quite aggressive ones, saying, China, don't get involved in our internal affairs, the usual spiel, and going so far with some slogans and signs to threaten China. If you get involved and if you support the so-called terrorists, we'll fight back, and et cetera, et cetera. So it appears as though, the military, say the SEC, probably crossed a line. It's, they. Everyone knows that at a time where anyone who even dares to shout out in the streets against the military or make any sort of political statement loudly is going to get captured and arrested by the military junta. At a time like this, when these guys, several dozens of people are going out protesting in public. Well, obviously, the military allowed it to happen, and everyone knew, and I'm sure the Chinese are able to tell, it's the military's proxies, right? So that happened, and also just a few days ago, over 100 trucks loaded with goods were burned at a border crossing gate compound in Muse. Some reports say that it was SAC artillery shelling. Some reports say that it was drone bombings by the Brotherhood Alliance. Conflicting reports, but the fact is that, those over trucks full of goods, supposedly, well, reportedly, Chinese goods to be sold in Myanmar, got burned in the fighting. So the pro plus that incident, and just a few days ago, after those two incidents, Chinese Foreign Ministry, asked the Myanmar ambassador, well, the SCC's ambassador in Beijing, to for to come over, and he was given a stern lecture. The details of the conversation unknown, but I'm assuming it's Beijing showing displeasure very publicly with the way the SEC has been throwing a tantrum.
That's very interesting, actually. I mean, in many ways, would it be fair to say that there is unprecedented levels of friction and tension between the SSE and Beijing right now, and that the SSE is almost through its proxies on the streets trying to signal to Beijing that it's unhappy with what they're doing in Myanmar in terms of supporting the PDFs, sorry, supporting mostly the ethnic armies in the north. So do you think this shows some kind of never before seen kind of tension between the SSE and China?
I'm not sure if I would call it never before seen, but definitely it's a noteworthy level of tension. In 2019, with the fighting between the Damaro and the American army in Rakhine State, they found, they found incidents of, China-made weapons in the hands of the American army and all that. You probably, I'm sure, will remember, was it in 2019 that bought a submarine from India? And I think that was one of the things where they wanted to show, displeasure at China and say, well, we've got other friends as well.
Yeah, that was in 2020. A Kilo class Soviet-made diesel electric submarine, which India transferred to the Tatmadaw Navy at the time. But yeah, I do remember that incident from 2019, where I think Minh Aung Hlaing also made some kind of a public statement criticizing China and calling out China without actually taking China's name, saying that some foreign powers are supporting terrorists, while basically alluding to the Arakan army. And by foreign power, he clearly meant China. So yeah, you're right. I don't think it's a new sort of development. The fact that Minh Aung Hlaing doesn't really like Beijing, and I think in many ways the dislike is mutual. It goes both ways. So I think in many ways we are seeing a culmination or a peaking of that mutual disdain today. But coming to India now, which is it's always a fascinating segue from China to India or the other way around, because in India, a lot of the commentary around Myanmar and the narratives around Myanmar, both within the policy and the civil society side of it, mostly within the policy side of it, is very, very China-centric, right? So it revolves around China. Whenever something happens in Myanmar that is linked to China, suddenly there's an escalation of interest in that particular event in India. So unfortunately, in many ways, India tends to see Myanmar through a China lens, which has, I would argue, as I've written in my pieces also, it has limited and constrained India's foreign policy towards post-coup Myanmar, right? But that's an entirely different story. What James, I want to pick your brains on is this. Operation 1027, as we've seen, has also spread to India's borders, particularly, I mean, across all the regions and states in Myanmar that border India. It's the Sagaing region, Chin State, and Arakan Army. We are seeing coordinated offensives and intense fighting between ethnic armies and the SSC, and also PDFs and the SSC. And not just that, joint battalions of ethnic armies, EOs, and PDFs in Sagaing region, for example. And of course, we are seeing renewed fighting in Arakan State. What I want to understand from you is the situation in Sagaing region and why Sagaing is, because for us in India, Sagaing is a bit of a blind spot in terms of analysis and understanding what's happening there. Because for Chin State and Rakhine State, I think we have better idea of what's happening, right? So because Chin State has identifiable groups, including most prominently the Chin National Front, which is a well-established group which has been around for a long time. So Indians recognize that group. The Indian policy and the security establishments also recognize that group. Same for the Arakan Army. It has been around for at least 6 7 years, right? So we do recognize Arakan Army as a particularly identifiable ethnic army in Rakhine State. But Sagaing region is something more complicated and new, right? Because we've seen that the fighting in Sagaing region started only after the coup, and there is no one big identifiable group in Sagaing region. It's mostly the battlefield in Sagaing is mostly populated by various People's Defense Forces, also some ethnic armed organizations like Kachin Independence Army in the north of Sagaing, where we have seen joint fighting and joint PDF KIA battalions fight the SSC. So tell us more about Sagaing. What's happening in Sagaing at the moment?
Where do I even start? Let's start off by saying that, Sagaing, in the north, it's a bit more ethnically diverse, but majority of Sagaing is populated by Bamar Buddhist majority, right? And Sagaing, when you even look at the term, it's not Sagaing State. We always called it the Sagaing region, and the sort of the context behind that is that it's assumed to be Bamar Buddhist majority in the state because it's not populated by any sort of ethnic minority group. There isn't a dominant ethnic minority group in that region. So Bamar Buddhist majority traditionally, where the military would recruit soldiers. And it being most Bamar Buddhist population, primarily Bamar Buddhist population, that the idea of a federal unit, the idea of Sagaing being a state within a federal system, regional autonomy, hardly ever crossed the minds of the people of Sagaing, because they've never really had to think about it, right? Until the coup, and since the coup began, Sagaing has been suffering, I would say, almost disproportionately, in the sense that there the majority of homes, villages burned down there in Sagaing, and because it's a Bamar Buddhist majority region, that there is no strong regional local militia like the Karen have with the KNLA, the Karenni have with the KNDF, and Rakhine with the Arakan Army, etc. That only when the coup happened, that the people of Sagaing had to form local PDF groups, right? Local PDF meaning they're not officially under the command of the NUG's Ministry of Defense. And there are so many different groups. By our over 100 local PDF groups. So it's, and there is a high degree of coordination. There's a high degree of, well, I would say at least, there is definitely that common interest of defending the people of Sagaing against the SAC that unites all these different groups. But politically, until the Sagaing Forum was officially formed in June of this year, there wasn't, a body that was actively working to unify and lead the various subgroups in the Sagaing region. There is the CRSH, which is the Committee Representing Sagaing Ludo. It's the regional grouping, like the CRPH, right? And then the CRSH representing Sagaing. The CRSH is a political body, and the NUG Ministry of Defense does have their security forces as well. But Sagaing being a huge region, and being in the north, a very diverse region, with the KIA presence there as well, that unlike, for example, in Karani State, with the the interim executive council, I believe, that there is no one unifying one umbrella body that's unifying all the various groups in Sagaing. Within that context, the Sagaing formed, and the Sagaing form, they have the political working groups, they have the security sector coordination group, they have humanitarian assistance network, ethnic affairs working group, and they have their organizing committee. And they have been in, they are public, you know, their meetings do get publicized, meetings with CRSH, meetings with NUCC, National Unity Consultative Council, meetings with, I think, also with the KNU. So what we can expect is perhaps with the Sagaing Forum and the Sagaing Forum's, how do I put this? Should I say the Sagaing Forum's leadership, or at least with the Sagaing Forum and its momentum, I think that, you know, before the SEC is gone, at least within the next year, we can hope to see a council or a committee of some sort representing Sagaing as a federal unit.
Right, that's very interesting, and I think that was a very nuanced analysis of what's going on in Sagaing, because we don't get to hear or read much about it, especially in India. And Sagaing is important. Let me also just, you know, say this, that Sagaing is important for India because one of India's, you know, most cherished or flagship, in a way, connectivity projects, the India-Myanmar-Thailand Trilateral Highway, which is also known as the Trans-Asian Highway, passes through Sagaing region, enters Myanmar through Moray and Tamu, which is Tamu being in Sagaing, and then, you know, goes southward towards Kalewa, and then onward to Moniwa, and then sort of to Mandalay. And also recently, the People's Defense Forces captured a major urban center, a town, on the route of the Trans-Asian Highway, which is Kampat, right, which is right next to southeastern Manipur, along the border of Sagaing region and Chin state. So there has been, in that sense, an expansion of the territorial control of the resistance in Sagaing region, which could have, you know, direct implications for India. So if I might ask you, if India wants to engage with some of the emerging political actors in Sagaing region, would Sagaing Forum be the ideal sort of a contact point, in that sense of Sagaing Forum representing most of the political and armed factions in Sagaing region, or would it be something else?
I would say from what the political landscape looks like right now, in terms of the reach, the outreach and representation, and the level of active political and social mobilization, the Sagaing Forum at this point looks like it might be that body, because at the second Sagaing Forum, there were 60 representatives from CSOs and revolutionary forces were present, and recently island groups made a statement on a draft interim regional constitution that was put forth by the CRSH. So in terms of, you know, one body that has its finger on the pulse, in terms of being able to mobilize a diverse set of stakeholders, at this point, it looks like it'll be the Sagaing Forum. And I believe that we can expect the Sagaing Forum, the CRSH, to continue having conversations over the future of the Gang region as well.
Right. I think there's just one last issue that I want to touch on for now. I, of course, hope that James, you return to this podcast in a future episode. But for now, I think, we've just like yesterday seen that Indonesia, who's the current ASEAN chair, outgoing ASEAN chair rather, is mobilizing a fresh initiative, kind of what is known as proximity talks between the SSC, the PDFs, sorry, the SSC, the NUG, and the EAOs to make them talk to each other. And just to be clear, proximity talks, the format proximity talks means that none of these guys are facing each other in the same room, but they're in different rooms, and there are go-betweens who carry messages between them. But we've seen that generally, after the initial phase of excitement of Indonesia's chairmanship and their very proactive sort of mediation effort, I think it pretty much fizzled out, and they were not able to achieve anything significant and not able to make things move forward, right? But suddenly we see this initiative coming up in the middle of Operation 1027, right? And as Laos prepares itself to take over the chairmanship of ASEAN, Indonesia is probably making a last-ditch effort to mobilize some kind of a negotiating forum or some kind of a format of talks that can be carried forward by Laos. But I want to get your views on generally, what do you think about this new initiative by Jakarta?
I'm really glad you asked that question because the way it's reported in mainstream media, especially when you read the headlines, it appears there's been some clandestine, oh, sorry, I wouldn't say clandestine, but closed door roundtable meeting with everyone sitting at the same table, but that wasn't the case. The NUG, the NUG's, spokesman has also come out and said that they do not sit at the same table with the PPSD or the SAC interlocutors. Right? What the reporting and the statement says on the website is that, and I quote, meeting facilitated by the Office of the Special Envoy, this conducted separately based on groupings. Right, interlocutors for the SAC, key representatives of the Spring Revolution Group, including the NUG, as well as representatives of the PPSC or the Seas Committee. So, the Office of the Special Envoy also facilitated the exchanges of messages from each group. So, what happened was the Office of the Envoy, from what it looks like, has been talking to different stakeholders, including the SAC's interlocutors, but it's not a case where, they brought everyone to the same table and asked them to hash it out. That wasn't the case. So that I think that clarification is important. And the second thing is, it was probably done for the benefit of incoming ASEAN chair Laos, in the sense that one, Laos probably needs to get up to speed on what it exactly happening in Myanmar, especially with the way things are developing and changing so quickly on the ground after the launch of Operation 1027. And second, I think it's it's Jakarta giving a subtle nudge to Laos and saying, well, the pressure is on you now to keep the conversation going and do the right thing. In terms of ASEAN and its efforts, regardless of the good intentions and strong positive will on the part of Indonesia and other ASEAN member states to do more for the Myanmar pro-democracy resistance, I think ASEAN as a mechanism, as we all know, there's only so far it can go. With the consensus principle, I would say that ASEAN's barring of high-level political representatives from attending ASEAN summits and foreign ministers' meetings is the farthest it has gone to censure a member state. And it's already done that. And there's the 5 points consensus, which in practice, it's incredibly difficult, almost impossible to implement, especially when there's zero political will on the part of the SEC to cooperate in any way. That, this is the most, I feel like ASEAN has done the most that it could have done. And I don't think it's realistic for us to expect ASEAN to do more, given the way the whole world works.
Yeah, I quite agree with you, actually. I think ASEAN's reached its maximum capacity, geopolitical capacity, regional capacity in terms of on what it can do. I don't think the ASEAN is even designed to undertake conflict mediation or conflict resolution of this kind. So I think it has done whatever it can do. But in most cases, that has come across as, in many ways, sort of ASEAN delaying a solution or, kicking the can down the road and seeing, just waiting and watching what happens. Personally, I don't have much hope from Lao PDR's upcoming chairmanship, because of the fact that the Laos has a string of strategic and economic interests with the Myanmar military, and also has this sort of orthodox way of operating, doing diplomacy, which is, talking to, again, the Indian style or the Chinese style, rather, of talking to whoever is in power in Naypyidaw. I mean, the Chinese have a much more diverse strategy, as we are seeing right now. But we can still hope against hope that something comes up. But I must say this, I think someone also wrote on Twitter, which is now called X, about this, which is that amidst all the, energy of Operation 1027 and all the chatter around the ongoing offensives, where we are witnessing rapid developments, I think all of us almost forgot that, the ASEAN also has an ongoing conflict resolution mechanism and the special envoy process on Myanmar, and that itself unfortunately shows the ineptitude of that entire mechanism in finding a solution. And this is something that I've been thinking, I can't stop thinking over the last few days, that, the resolution 1027 in many ways shows that this resolution to the Myanmar, quote unquote, Myanmar crisis will come from within Myanmar rather than outside Myanmar. It'll be the people of Myanmar who will affect radical transformative shifts on their own terms, rather than a group of governments in the region or even outside the region, doing their own sort of diplomatic maneuvers to affect any change. So I think 1027 very well and very sort of glaringly drives this point across. But James, thank you so much. I think we've covered a wide range of issues. I will probably not ask you to crystal gaze and give me a time frame within which things will radically change, which means the SSA would fall, because I'm very much not in favor of that kind of crystal gazing. But what I will ask you is that 2023 is coming to an end now, and we're getting into a new year. Do you think the SSC will collapse in 2024?
I certainly do think that the SEC will not last past the end of 2024. Even now, there's an irrelevancy based on internal SEC sources who spoke to the irrelevancy on condition of anonymity, that the SEC has already started recalling some troops from the front to defend Naypyidaw. They've started fortifying police stations, building bunkers, and setting up stronger defense mechanisms and networks. They do expect, everyone's been saying this for a while, all roads go to Naypyidaw. Naypyidaw is where we're headed. And I went to India, right? I'm always like genuinely confused because of, the way the Indian government has approached this whole issue in Myanmar. I mean, what does India really want from Myanmar, right? The way that China handled things, when you look at the timeline, the first year of the coup, 2021, yes, China will talk into the SEC for a lot of reasons, one of them being that they had control of They have control of Naypyidaw in Yangon, and the whole governance mechanism, administrative apparatus, and machinery of governing the country. But they also, especially in 2021, took a cautious approach, right? Never forget September 2021, at the UN, China being one of the P5 and sitting on the Credentials Committee, raised no issue with deferring the Myanmar permanent representative's credentials question, right? It was a unanimous decision, and they deferred the decision on the credentials of Ambassador John Mouton, which essentially, gave us another year of pro-democracy Ambassador John Mouton occupying our seat at the UN, right? By international law, there's like he's a representative of the state. Whether certain countries and entities and governments want to recognize the NUG or not, it's fine, but Ambassador John Mouton is there, and he supports the Myanmar pro-democracy movement. He works on behalf of the people, and China was involved in that decision making, right? And then until I suppose former Foreign Minister Chen Gang, until he met Mei Onglai in Naypyidaw in May 2023, China was taking a pretty cautious approach in that, they were still talking to EROs, pro-democracy forces behind closed doors as well, and at the same time talking to the regime in Naypyidaw, but refused to shake hands with Mei Onglai. And then now with Operation 1027, everyone knows that, China in some fashion was involved, either gave the green light, if you want to look at it that way, or they either looked the other way. So China knows that they're not with the Myanmar public. So in the absence of popularity with the Myanmar public, what China did with Operation 1027, they chose to strengthen their leverage and do expect China to be expanding that influence into Zagain as well, where they have business interests, right? And let's not forget the China and Myanmar Economic Corridor. We often think about the China Myanmar Economic Corridor with the head, just the head and the tail, right? The tail in Jiaxing in southern Rakhine, and the head in Shan in the state, right? But the body of it traverses, I believe, Mandalay and Maguey, right? Burma majority regions. So it makes sense for China to try to somehow expand their influence and footprint in the Ma majority regions as well. So my question is, what is India going to do? How will they respond to that, especially when China starts expanding influence and its footprint in Zagain?
Yeah, I think you asked initially what does India want. I think there's a whole different podcast on that, and probably we should do it soon. But what's fascinating is that ultimately at the core, India has interests which are very similar, which look very similar to those of Chinese interests in Myanmar, be it strategic interests regarding the border security of the borders of their borders, economic interests, and larger geostrategic and geopolitical interests. Right, gaining access, among which gaining access to the Indian Ocean, building economic corridors, and west-east connectivity or north-south connectivity in China's case. So I think the interests are pretty similar. The difference is that China has played from the front foot, I feel. It's been more tenacious, it's been more sort of forthright about protecting its interests, and more than most importantly, I think it has shown a kind of political and strategic agility and adaptability that I feel has been missing from India's strategy in Myanmar. And I have been writing about this, you also know, I've been writing about this in the last 2 years, and I've been very critical of India's policy in Myanmar, that in order to protect India's own strategic interests and political interests in Myanmar, India should have much earlier, right after the coup, diversified, seriously diversified its relationships, and rather very, very seriously and committedly engage with the pro-democracy side. I think that will have done good for India's own image in Myanmar, which India has so meticulously sort of built over the last 10 years through a range of things. For example, the Development Aid Program, which invested in capacity building, social development, etc. So I think India was quite risk averse in that sense and reticent of acting on mobilizing diplomatic resources and assets to protect its interests. China, on the other hand, was more forthright. But as I said, there's a whole different podcast that we could do on that, and we should do it because there's a lot to unpack there, especially in light of Operation 1027. But yes, as I said, James, thank you so much. You helped me, and I'm pretty sure our listeners make so much better sense of what's happening. A lot of the events are complex and are at the risk of being seen out of context. I think you put them in the right context, and I hope to have you again in my podcast. Thanks, James.
Thank you very much, and I hope to be on another podcast again. And as you said, you know, the question of what India wants with Myanmar and from Myanmar, maybe we should do a whole episode on that one. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Bab Dwais podcast. You'll find this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Stitcher. I'm trying to get this podcast placed on other platforms, but until then, wherever you listen to this podcast, just hit the subscribe button to get the latest episodes whenever they're out.